47 of Divergent Paths with Dan Dunford, etc., etc. Glad you're listening to it. It's awesome. You know, podcast cliches and such. This is unusual. I'm not by myself when I'm recording this. I have an annoying person next to me. Say hi, Kate.
Hi.
Yep, that's how that goes. I hope you're enjoying your week. I hope you're as obsessed with Pokemon Go as the rest of the world is, including myself. I find myself on gigs looking for Pokemon. It's great because I'm an adult. Anyway, this week's guest, cellist Emily Davidson. She was quite a delight to talk to. Emilio Guarino from several weeks ago turned me on to her and had a fun time doing my first interview over Skype. So it will sound a little different, and it definitely took me a minute, no, more like 20 minutes, 10 to 20 minutes to really get comfortable with talking to someone I couldn't see. It was a little bit, took a second for me, but we did end up having a good conversation, got into good stuff. So I hope you enjoy that. Emily had some cool, has done a lot of cool stuff. Had some of her things picked up by Huffington Post and Classic FM's music blog, which is how I saw more, and most people saw her stuff first. I would imagine, a lot of people saw her stuff because of that. She specializes in Baroque cello, and I really had a good time. So two of her tracks are featured on this episode. Before the interview is the Retrocar by good old brass friend Giovanni Gabrielli. Obviously not played on a brass instrument. We can't all be perfect. But anyway, no, I'm just kidding. It sounds great. And afterwards, the Sarah Bond from the first Bach Cello Suite, which, if you've never heard Bach Cello Suites performed on Baroque cello, that's how I, my go-to recordings of the Bach Suites are on Baroque cello, and I think it's something really cool. If you want to follow Emily's things on social media, you can check out all of her stuff at emilyplayscello.com, and that is also her handle on Instagram and Twitter. It's emilyplayscello. So hit her up there and check out what she's doing. And if you enjoy the interview, please like the podcast on Facebook and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Check it out on Google Play if that's what you use. Also, keep an eye out for the launch of the YouTube channel, which will be happening sometime this week, I think. I'm in the process of uploading all of the episodes, which takes forever. But then after that, I'll have some nice original content, stuff that's not on the podcast. So keep an eye out for that. If you follow me on any social media, you won't be able to avoid it. So anyway, enjoy your week. Bye. So first off, thanks for agreeing to talk to me. This is it's really nice. I just recently, this week, put up an interview with my buddy Emilio, and it was like middle of the. We were talking about like public imaging and then setting up social media presence and all this stuff. And he's like, oh yeah, I just met this person the other day and she seemed really cool. And I was like, oh, I'll look up this person. So that's how I ended
Nice.
It was, and it was like later after we finished, recording, I just did like a bunch of podcast related stuff and it all worked out. It was great. So first off, recently, like, you know, you had over the past 4 or 6 weeks, you've been featured on a couple different more things on a more national scale than possibly earlier in your career. I just kind of out of the, you know, you mentioned that you've been getting a lot more. You've had a lot more people reaching out to you, of course, one of those people being me. Like, was that just, like, a lot? You know, because, you know, when we graduate from school and we start in our whatever careers we choose as musicians, it's, you just get used to no one paying attention, right? I mean, a lot of times the stuff that people are most passionate about is the stuff that gets the least, that provides the least amount of money for themselves. Yeah. I talk to people a lot where it's always this long process where their passion projects, it takes 5-6 years before anyone really starts to notice and before it starts to provide any kind of monetary support, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. When you're having more national type deals reaching out to you, is that a little bit not unusual? I guess the word yes, unusual, but a little bit disconcerting in a way if you're not used to that kind of thing.
I think for me, I mean, and hopefully all of us, you know, we're always kind of striving for big things. And I think when you have the passion and the dedication to start your own project and you have to invest all this time and you're not getting much back in the beginning, I think the dream is to get that kind of recognition. You hope and aspire. And at least for someone like me, I use the potential for getting that kind of attention to motivate me. Like, wow, if I did this amazing project and it goes really well, you know, what if it got this? I don't really think of specifics. But I'm just kind of thinking about, like, wow, it would be great, you know, if some people notice this. So when it happens, it feels great.
So specifically, there was one, there's one video in particular that kind of hit, if you will, that Classical FM and HuffPost kind of picked up on. So what was the deal with that?
Yeah, so that video was something I've been thinking about doing for a while, because now that I'm kind of putting myself out there a lot and I'm starting to get people really following me, and I, especially since I've been out of school a couple years now, I look, you know, like an established professional, which I am. And
it's funny, like people will be like, oh yeah, you're an established professional, but it takes a long time to actually feel like it. I don't know that, but that might just be my personal experience.
No, I think that's definitely true. And there are a lot of people who appear to be an established professional because maybe they have a few like really high end looking projects or gigs, but then, you know, they're a barista on the weekends, which is fine. But, because of that, they may not feel as established as they appear because of this one prestigious gig that they have. So yeah, it just really kind of depends, and everyone has their own definition of what being successful means. But at least for me, you know, I started getting the feeling that I should open up a little bit more about how hard things were for me in the beginning, and also how many people really kind of didn't believe in me. And I always believed in myself. I'm a pretty confident person. I had great parents who always told me how awesome I was. So I didn't really have trouble believing in myself. But I felt that the people around me, especially, you know, I entered when I was taking my college auditions to be a music major. I had less than 2 years of private lessons at that time, and I was still learning all the same repertoire as the people who had 10 years of private lessons. So I was really kind of up against people in a completely different league than myself. So I expected to catch up when I got to college, and unfortunately, I didn't have good chemistry with my teacher. I didn't really get the guidance I needed to catch up. So it was this kind of rocky road trying to make up for lost time, but not really having the tools that I needed to make up for the lost time. And all the while, the faculty members and my peers, everyone kind of looking at me as this girl who's just kind of not as good as everybody else, because you can't really go up to people and say, hey, I know I don't sound as good as everyone, but I only had a few years of lessons. You know, you can't really make excuses for yourself.
Yeah.
So I sort of had to go through with this shadow over me of, you know, not being very good despite being really interested and passionate and, in my opinion, doing really well considering the amount of time I had been given. So that was – it was really difficult for me, and really most of my – all four of my undergraduate years were kind of like that. And – I thought it would make sense to sort of talk about that a little bit because, you know, I was able to overcome that. You know, I continued on to grad school, and then I really found my way playing Baroque cello, which was, you know, much more, I felt more connected to that. And then I was able to make progress from there. And now I feel really good about where I am, even comparing myself to people I was in school with back then and where I am. I feel like I really have done the catching up that I needed to do. And I wanted to tell others, you know, if you're behind, if you're in a situation that's unfavorable, you know, there's going to be a lot of negativity. There's going to be a lot of people who don't give you the support you need just because, you know, you weren't that sort of child prodigy vibe that we like so much in classical music for some reason. And, and I think it was important to talk about it.
Yeah. And it's hard to talk about, like, I living in New York, being active in the freelance community here, I'm often sitting in a trombone section with guys who are much older, let's put it that way. Guys who've been established on the scene for decades, usually many decades, and it's just a different kind of approach. I mean, if you were to say something about not getting the support that you might need emotionally to create good music, they'll look at you like you've got a third head or a second head, I guess, would be just as weird. and, you know, it's just kind of a deal as in, like, well, you know, do tough shit, get yourself together. And it's just now that musicians have a better understanding about how things affect people psychologically, it's opened up a lot more ways to kind of look at how to approach, you know, whether you're ahead, whether you're behind, you know, that kind of a thing. So you spend, you know, I guess film yourself talking about these kind of things.
Yeah, the technical term is a vlog, but yes.
Well, I mean, yeah, I've always hated that word personally, but I guess it's interesting. The style that you use on your YouTube channel is one that was there's a lot of, you know, it over the last 5-6 years, the rise of the YouTube star, quote unquote, has been, I guess you could say, meteoric, particularly when it comes to people in a more comedy centric world. You've got, you know, the video games, comedy skits type of deal. I've always been a big fan of people like Grace Helbig or Mamrie Hart. Those are very different, you know, genres. And comes along with a very specific sensibility and look, if that makes sense. You know, these funny things with, like, these smash cuts and you know, funny voices, funny faces, like gimmicks and that kind of a deal. Now, why go in that direction on a classical music side? Because it's the way it works is a little bit different. You can't be quite as snappy, let's put it that way.
Yeah, and you know, if you wanted to, you could be. I do know a few kind of classical music affiliated type people who really do try to make a YouTube channel that is based off of that same sort of like comedic style and commentary and silly and trying to show that classical music can be fun and all this stuff, which I think is great. That's not exactly what I'm doing. I mean, my videos are definitely they're educational when they're lessons. They're just I guess they're always kind of educational because even when I play repertoire or perform something, I usually discuss the piece or the instrument or something like that. And it was sort of a new thing for me to add a personal story, like what I did about being the underdog in college. I really think YouTube is a platform that you can make of it whatever you will. I mean, the whole concept already that you basically have a channel, an area where you can share video content that you completely tailor yourself, really leaves the possibilities open. And I haven't found anything similar to that that seems like a good option. I do really like Instagram. That's another platform that I really enjoy. And music is a great thing for Instagram. I mean, they've expanded to now allow 1 minute videos instead of 15-second videos. So you can share a decent musical excerpt on Instagram, and it seems like people are interested in getting a little burst of music on their phone when they're just kind of surfing through their feed. But YouTube just really lets you branch out. And I think there are a lot of people that go to YouTube for information. You know, they search how to do something or they want to learn about something and they want to find a YouTube video that explains it rather than an article where they have to kind of read it or skim it or whatever. So, yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's, I mean, that's true. It's a little bit, it to kind of compare it to the, this, I guess old school style of thinking. It's kind of counterintuitive to what has traditionally been how you would approach classical music, but it's one in which you can reach out to more people than you might than well, obviously more people than you would be able to otherwise. I mean, and it's just, visual as opposed to text-based. I'm more of a text-based guy, but I do understand the appeal. Let's talk a little bit more about your background as far as your musical path. You're from question mark.
I'm from the New York area originally, the suburbs, just outside of the city, a little town called Nyack. It's right on the Hudson River. So, great place to grow up, super cultural. There were like Met opera players who lived in my town because they didn't want to live in the city. So it was a great place to live and grow up because the arts culture was really great. You could get into New York in 45 minutes or less. So that's where I grew up, and then I've kind of stayed northeast all my adult life. Went to college in Connecticut and then grad school in Boston, and now I'm still in Boston. So kind
Now,
of New England.
were you, you know, do you have musicians in your family? I mean, were there people pointing you in this direction, or was it just kind of something you chose yourself?
It was pretty much me. My dad is a musician, but he was a composer and a jazz guitarist. So totally different world. I don't have any classical musicians in my family anywhere on either side, any parts removed, no classical music in my family. So the cello and classical music was all my doing.
And it's not just like you're doing classical music, you're doing like hyper classical music, like
Yeah.
going as far back into like the historicity of it as possible, which I think is hilarious. But why into if without that kind of like background of music? I mean jazz and composition, in your family, that's a very different thing. Like, why did you go into this direction if there was no, nothing really pushing you in that down that path?
Well, so I was playing cello very casually. So it was like a public school orchestra kind of situation for me. So, I always had an interest in music, and my dad, being a musician, was very supportive of that. He never pushed anything, but I did take a little bit of piano lessons when I was a kid, and when I got tired of them, my parents let me quit. I was self-taught on guitar. Basically, my dad said, "Here's how you read a chord chart," and then got me a guitar, and I would mess around on guitar and write little songs when I was in elementary school. So I was very musically inclined, but I didn't have any serious training going on. And they fourth grade, they all bring you down to the gym or whatever and say, okay, you can pick an instrument if you want to play an instrument, and not really a special moment of any kind. I just thought, oh, the violin's pretty screechy. The viola sounds pretty weird. I guess I'll play the cello. And I sort of just continued learning how to read music and play the cello through my public school orchestra, which is like a once a week kind of thing. So I had the cello going on, but it didn't feel like a part of my life or anything that I was really investing in. It was just sort of another thing that I did. And then in high school, our orchestra program, which was not so great if you can't already tell by the story, we got a really great orchestra teacher in my high school who wanted to revamp the whole program. And one of the things she wanted to do was get everybody taking private lessons, because there really weren't many people doing that in my district. And she kind of honed in on the people that seemed like they were the most kind of interested in it. And I always loved being in orchestra. I found it fun. So she kind of got on me like, hey, have you considered taking private lessons? I know a teacher, you know. Now that I'm on the other side of that, the teacher, I realized, oh, she had a friend who was a cello teacher, and she was giving him the hookup by getting him some lessons. So I kind of get how it all was working at the time, now that I'm a professional myself. But it worked out great for me because I loved the teacher. And as soon as I had somebody actually working with me one-on-one on the cello, it came to life for me. And I thought, wow, I love playing this music, and I love now I can actually learn how to do things on my instrument as opposed to just sort of coasting in orchestra. So I was 14 going on 15 when I first started those private lessons, and it really took off from there, because by 16 I was doing college auditions to be a music major. So it was very fast once the lessons started.
So you've already, like, you know, you already touched on the idea of not necessarily feeling like you were behind, right? So, you know, when you're in that sort of a situation, particularly among string students, that's very late to start private lessons. I mean, even if you were playing a brass instrument, that would be pretty late. So when you're in that position where when you feel like people have such a head start on you, like, how did you end up motivating yourself and pushing forward? Like, I realize, I mean, we've touched on this already, but and why didn't you just quit? that's a fair, you know, a lot of times that's enough to make someone, you know, just stop what they're doing.
Right. Well, I think, for one, the only way that I was able to make up for lost time and work really hard was because I really loved it. And I think a lot of people who start so young that it's not even their choice to start an instrument or to take lessons or to practice, it's not really a decision that they own or feel like is a part of them. It's something, oh, my parents made me play this, my parents are making me practice. And there's a certain disconnect there, and it's easy to lose passion and steam when you're not really the one calling the shots. And I was really lucky to have parents that were very supportive but not pushy at all. So playing the cello, practicing my cello, all of that was really my decision from the age that I started, 14, 15 years old. So that sort of made me feel personally invested, and I loved it enough. I remember, you know, being a 15 and a half, going on 16, getting ready for college auditions, and I told myself, okay, I can't practice any other music but college audition music until I've done 3 hours of practice for my audition. And that was just like the rule I made for myself at 15 years old, because I thought, I gotta practice. I can't play this music yet. And that was, you know, I guess I didn't think of myself as a particularly ambitious, overachieving kid, but, you know, I knew the work I had to do. And I think also when I was in high school, because even though I was behind in the grand scheme of things, I was still pretty advanced for my school district. Mm-hmm. Like I said, the program was not very good. So I still felt like kind of a hot shot cello player in my little public school, which I think kept my ego preserved at that young age. You know, even though on a global or a national scale, I was behind, at least on the day-to-day at school, I was able to identify as a cello player, feel good about my cello playing. People saw me as a good cello player. So when I was first starting, that little ego boost, I think, helped keep me kind of healthy and happy about it. And it wasn't until college that things started to get a little more challenging with that kind of attitude.
Well, I mean, going from being the big fish in the small pond to the small fish, et cetera, et cetera. I don't need to complete that overused analogy. So when
when did you finish up your undergrad and your master's?
So undergrad, I finished in 2010, and then I went straight on to master's, and I was done in 2012.
So when in this point did you start like shifting into more of the Baroque cello type of deal? I mean, that's I've heard plenty of not even just non-cellists, but cellists as well, kind of I'm just gonna say shit talk Baroque cello. like it's from the people I've talked to, it can sometimes be spoken of as a little bit of the redheaded stepchild.
This is the stuff I don't get to hear because people don't say this to me.
Well, I mean, it's just, you know, oh, the sound isn't full enough, or, you know, it's really weird, like, trying to play it is really strange, or this and that and the other thing, okay? So, these are things that I've heard, and I've had spoken to me. Now, I personally, you know, now I'm going to put out my bona fides, I personally am a fan of Baroque cello. This is not just sucking up. My first recording of Bach cello suites were Peter Whispelway on playing them on Baroque cello, and those are still my favorites. But why, you know, that's a very specific direction to go in. Why would you do that? It's not, there's a lot of shit that goes into that technique wise and sound concept wise.
Yeah, definitely. I think I always loved Baroque music. I know, like, when I was still a high schooler, like, Bach, Vivaldi, you know, I didn't know about, like, all the more obscure 17th century guys at the time. Though I actually really did have, I had a Moret CD that I loved in high school. Yes. I didn't even know what the instruments were. I didn't know what a viola da gamba was. But I would listen to that with harpsichord and gamba and all this stuff. And I just loved the sound. I remember before playing concerts in high school, I listened to my Moret CD to, like, get chilled out. So I always had an ear for Baroque music, but I didn't really go after it specifically. You know, a lot of my concertos and things that I chose to do were like Vivaldi and stuff. But to me, I still kind of liked, you know, I still liked the Swan and like the big romantic pieces as well. But when I entered college, there was not a lot of Baroque music at my school. And there's not at a lot of conservatories. You know?
Of course not.
We want to include all the brass and percussion players, and we want to get everything all large scale. So then we end up playing Mahler and all this stuff. And so there's just not a lot of room left for the earlier stuff.
It's funny. I did most of my college work at Manus, and Manus was one of the first was the first conservatory in New York to even have an early music performance program. And then all of a sudden they shut it down, and now Juilliard has like the prestigious one. It's a weird thing. Like some schools have it, and sometimes it's really good, and sometimes it's like one harpsichord major. Anyway,
yeah, exactly. Sarah,
please continue.
So I was sort of, I think it was maybe the beginning of my sophomore year, so I'd been at college for a year, and I kind of felt like something was missing in my musical life, and I sort of realized like, hey, I never play Baroque music, like my repertoire and my lessons and the stuff I play in orchestra, and that's kind of all I have, maybe chamber music. Was, you know, later string quartets or something, and I just didn't have Baroque music going on at all, and I saw that we had a Baroque ensemble, so I thought, okay, like, I'll check this out. And unfortunately, I think a lot of schools have this story. If you have a Baroque ensemble, it's, like, kind of ghetto. It's, like, violinists thinking, like, oh, I'm not going to have to play out of first position. I'll just take this, and I won't practice. And, you know, it wasn't the most amazing situation, but there was a really great teacher who actually did a ton of Baroque violin playing professionally, who was just a beacon of knowledge. And despite the students not really caring that much about the ensemble, he was an amazing resource for me. And playing in the ensemble, I still got, you know, sort of interested again in the repertoire. And at the time, I think there were a few people at my school who had done some Baroque summer workshops, and anybody who's done any kind of early music, anything, knows that the summer workshops are where it's at. There's a ton of them in the country. Not a ton, but enough for you to have options. And that's where you can really go and get your feet wet, because they either have, you know, Baroque instruments and bows for you to borrow, or they'll help you get gut strings, whatever you need. So it's a great way to kind of test out if you're going to be interested in the performance practice stuff. So I figured, why not? Like, I'll do a summer workshop and see if this is what I like. And I did the workshop at Oberlin, which has a pretty good reputation. It's been around for a long time and is particularly good with people who are just starting out in Baroque style. So I kind of went in as like, I'm going to try this and see if this Baroque music thing is for me. I'm just going to try it out. And I went to the workshop and it was like the first day was over and there was no question. I was like, I love this. This is completely natural for me. You know, the teacher there sort of sat down and said, okay, this is how you would play this on modern cello. This is how you're going to play it on Baroque cello. Here's what we're emphasizing differently. She really laid down the differences. And I had been struggling with technique stuff, you know, trying to catch up and trying to be a better cellist, you know, and catch up with my peers and all that. And the Baroque technique stuff just felt natural to me instantly. Like all the things I had been fighting and trying to get better at were suddenly removed. And there was this new technique that felt almost effortless. And it was a weird phenomenon to be at this workshop with other modern players who had great modern technique. And they're really struggling to do this Baroque stuff. It goes against everything that they've learned to do. And I'm over here like, whoa, this actually feels good to me. This actually makes sense now. And it was sort of like there was no argument at that point. Like I had found where I belonged as a cellist. And it was pretty clear to me right then.
With early music and historical performance practices, let's put it that way. Sometimes you read people's opinions about these things. Now, there's a number of especially in the Boston area, there's a lot of there's a strong historical performance community, correct?
Yes.
And not just string wise. I mean, woodwinds, historical brass. So I think it's probably the only place in the country where there's an ensemble that actually uses serpent. I mean, come on, that's. but why? What do you think is important about preserving the actual, not just the music, not just the physical music, but the actual practices of an art form from 300 years ago? Or, you know, I'm not, I'm just curious because I have, you know, I hear some people will say, you know, well, we should always be pushing forward. And other people who say that, oh, well, we need to preserve, you know, this part of our past. I mean, what do you see as the importance of really continuing to perform this, but, you know, in the methods that were used, you know, prior to Bach, really?
Right. So, I mean, for one, if there are classical musicians saying, you know, oh, there's no point in doing early music, blah, blah, blah. It's like, why are you playing classical music in the first place? Like, what do you think you're doing playing Beethoven on this instrument that is like has all these modern things on it, and then you want to play something that's still really old and act like you're playing something old, but you're doing it in a modern way? It's like there's all this juxtaposition and like kind of justifying where it's convenient for yourself and then where it's not convenient, saying, oh, but I play classical music. It's kind of, it doesn't really make sense to me. If you want to play this old repertoire and you want to honor it, it would make sense that you would get into it a little bit. You wouldn't, you know, use all these totally modern conventions and then act like you're doing something historical. It's just a little bit backwards to me.
To be fair, the people who would say, like, at least the people that I'm involved with who would say something like that would also be advocating for not playing music from that time period. So,
if you're a new music person or you're into more contemporary stuff, you know, more power to you. Everyone is interested in different repertoire. You know, that's totally fine.
That being said, I personally am, I would say Bach is my favorite composer, and I very much enjoy playing music from prior to that. However, you know, I don't play a string instrument, right? Bach didn't write anything for trombone. I'm going to keep using Bach because that's, you know, what's on my music stand right now, as an example, even though early music is generally, you know, can a lot of times encompasses lesser known composers from before Bach's time, but I'm just going to keep going with this. You know, I play a trombone. So, you know, it can sometimes seem when you're talking about this kind of music from your point of view, or I don't want to put you in a box of my own making, but from that point of view, it can sometimes seem like that it makes my performance of Bach on an instrument that didn't even exist in its current state in 1680, so in some ways illegitimate. Now,
I've heard this before from wind players, especially. Like I had a clarinetist roommate who was like, seemed vaguely uncomfortable with the fact that I did early music and saying, my instrument wasn't even around back then. Are you saying that my instrument isn't worth anything? That kind of attitude. And I totally get that. And I think anybody that plays early music loves the music and wants it to continue on to the future. And if that means playing it on an instrument that it wasn't meant for or whatever, I don't think that bothers that many people. I think we want this music to live on. We want people to love it, to play it, to interpret it in whatever way they choose. Like, we love this music. So I think there's too much of a stigma on, like, we want it to be done right. And I think if you actually talk to early music people, that's not quite how we feel.
That's totally fair. There's just like the early music community in New York is not quite as strong as the early music community in the New England region. So I don't have that much, you know, especially as a trombone player, I'm not overlapping with people like that often.
Yeah. And I think there is a stigma though, because even especially among string players, you know, if there's a modern violinist who doesn't play any broke violin, they see a broke violinist and they instantly get kind of offended and insecure. Like, oh, are you saying that when I play a Bach partita that I'm not doing it right? And no one's actually saying that. I think there's sort of some weird insecurities around that for some reason. But I think the idea of using the old equipment and taking the historical approach isn't about doing it the right way. It's about doing it in a way that actually makes the music all that it can be. Because, you know, you hear it all the time that people think Baroque music is boring and this and that. It gets the boring thing a lot more than other, you know, areas of classical music. And one of the reasons I think that it comes across as boring is because a lot of people are playing it with no sensibility of what it meant at the time. You have to get into the context of what you're playing to really understand what it meant. Like, yes, when Bach was laying out, you know, the foundation of tonal harmony for the rest of time, it doesn't sound groundbreaking to us now all the time. It sounds like, oh, okay, a one chord, a five chord, yep, I get it. But if you get into Bach's time, it will sound groundbreaking, and you have to be a little bit more immersed in the context to understand that. And I think also there are a lot of musical rules from the Baroque that sort of got put away as the classical period came in, and the romantic period. And so then we don't even, a lot of times our classical music training doesn't even teach us about these huge musical principles that they were working with in the Baroque. So then we play this music with no sensibility of the principles they were working with. So it makes no sense, or it sounds kind of bland, and then we leave it at that. Or worse, we try to make it into something that it isn't, and we try to play it like it's Brahms or like it's Mahler, and we try to make a melody when there isn't a melody, or we gloss over really important harmonies because they don't sound that interesting compared to Mahler, but at the time they were interesting, and we need to have that awareness in order to make the repertoire really as vibrant as it was back then.
Yeah, I, you know, it's... It's funny, yeah. I had an interesting experience with this kind of thing specifically. I was performing the first movement of the E major, Bach E major violin concerto, right? And in a masterclass type setting, in a setting for a well-known principal trombonist in an orchestra that is not in New York, so I'm not going to say his name, but. But I played this piece for him, and you know, it's, you know, I did whatever my things, you know, afterwards he was like, oh, well, it's a dance, right? So why don't you play it like a dance? And I was like, well, it's this piece. I mean, even if you do the most basic level of research, I'm not saying that this trombone player should have known a Bach violin concerto necessarily, but you know, it's like, well, no, I did a very small amount of research and found out that it was actually a song, an aria da capo format, not some sort of generic dance like you're saying. So that literally took 20 seconds. I mean, for me, like for a non-string player, it's a little bit of a different approach that I found, because I do love playing that these time periods. For me, it's a little more about finding out what the rules are and then breaking the ones that I feel like breaking while continuing to keep some of them intact.
Sure. I mean, and that's just artistic decisions 101. But, I mean, you're not going to follow every rule.
Right. But it's, you know, what you're saying about like just knowing it is valuable and can manifest itself in ways that you might not even see initially.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that's one of my biggest, you know, qualms with the modern approach is that, you know, you don't have to play it this way, but don't be ignorant. Don't just jump into this piece knowing nothing and thinking, well, don't challenge my interpretation. Your interpretation's weird. It's like, but at least my interpretation involves some research and understanding, you know, not just, oh, well, you know, my teacher always told me to vibrate when I have a half note. So that's what I'm going to, you know, it's just, I think that you can go a little deeper and a lot of people choose not to.
To be fair to this unnamed mass of people, you know, a lot of them don't do research on Brahms or Sibelius either. So
yeah, and I think why are you in classical music if you don't really want to? You know, I'm not. Yes, I went into a scholarly field and I got my master's and I had to write papers and stuff. But I'm not like a crazy scholar. I'm still a performer. Like that's still what I want to do is play my instrument and. You know, I just think if you're in classical music, like, why are you playing this old dead music if you don't have some interest in learning about it and understanding, you know, its role in history and understanding the composer? To me, even like as a young teen, that was super fascinating to think about what the composer was going through and what he was thinking when he was writing these pieces and what he was trying to convey. I mean, if you're not going to get into that on some level, I don't see why you should be playing this older music in the first place.
Yeah, that's... You know, well, of course, it just makes sense. So, in addition to the solo work that you do, the historically informed solo work that you do, you're also the director of a period instrument string quartet called the Emergence Quartet, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we're democratic. I wouldn't say I founded the group, but I'd say we're pretty democratic. I'm not the director. We all direct each other.
that's very political of you. So for those people, including myself, who aren't entirely sure what a period instrument string quartet entails, what does that even mean?
I mean, I founded the group because every string player likes playing string quartets, just fact right there. I mean, it's just one of the most fun ensembles to be in as a string player because you can just really get into the blend. There's so much repertoire. Like, string quartets are just fun no matter where you're coming from. So I wanted to be in a string quartet, but I, being more on the Baroque side of things, I wanted to explore kind of the earlier pieces written for string quartet, perhaps before the term string quartet was being thrown around. So the idea of a piece for two violins, viola, and cello, that sort of starts setting the groundwork for what the string quartet genre will become. And in doing so, I wanted to do it all on, you know, period instruments, gut strings, Baroque bows, those set up just because that's how I like to play this kind of repertoire is with the equipment that the composers would have seen themselves. So it started out playing some earlier pieces from the Baroque and early classical period. But as we've grown as a group, we've been together almost 3 years now, we've expanded a little bit and played some classical repertoire. We've done some early Haydn and gone as late as Mozart, which causes us to have to do some adaptations. We change our pitch from 4:15 to 4:30. We'll use transitional or classical bows instead of the Baroque bows. So we kind of explore, you know, what sort of equipment and techniques were used, you know, during the composer's time period, and then kind of just explore all this music written for two violins, viola, and cello, sort of pre-1800.
Fair enough. that doesn't. I'm like that didn't really leave me an opening for a follow up question.
Sorry.
In a typical performance by your quartet, what repertoire would that entail?
So our programs have varied, but we were actually
in your typical in its initial. I don't want to say intended, but iteration of like
period, yeah, sure. Like period our, music. Our pilot program. So we sort of traced a little bit of the string quartet through time, which was a cool thing to do. I think we played there was a piece by Telemann, and I think it was either called a sinfonia or a sonata or something like that, right. But it was written for two violins, viola, and cello. So nobody would see that and call it a string quartet, but it is written for a string quartet. It is a piece for a string quartet. So exploring pieces like that, that you would not think of in that way, but that are, you know, intended for that instrumentation. So that we had that Telemann. We've occasionally done some arrangements, like we had a Fausch piece that, you know, had technically a continual part, though interesting tidbit, we actually did an early Haydn string quartet, and we use, when we can, we use like manuscript facsimile early parts when we can. There were actually figured bass, you know, indications in the cello part.
Interesting.
And yeah, you wouldn't expect that there was a harpsichord sitting there playing along with the string quartet, but perhaps it was just normal for them to know the harmonies for every single chord, and so they put the figured bass in. But so, yeah, we would do Haydn, you know, he's the father of the string quartet. So we love to include Haydn when we can because, you know, his first string quartets were not even called a string quartet because that term wasn't even a thing yet. right. But he was writing those pieces. So some early Haydn, some Baroque pieces for our instrumentation. We actually recently did Mozart Dissonance Quartet, which was a big reach for us because it's much later in time. But we are branching out in that way and just kind of covering it all in that sort of early time frame.
So I have to ask about like the things that I'm really interested in, which is in your the part of your career that involves DJing. That's, you know, because that's like, you know, real music. It's music that people want to listen. I'm just kidding. but actually, like, if you'll excuse the phrase, like, what the fuck? I'm not sure I understand, like, not, I know I get the draw, but I'm just curious as to, like, what the fuck?
Yeah, so it's definitely a little strange, and I haven't yet found a way to really bring my cello playing, especially being that I play Baroque cello, and my DJing together. Right now they are fairly separate entities. So I guess I'll start at the beginning. The beginning of the story is that my brother is a professional DJ, my older brother. And he actually specializes in video game music. So if you think there's anything more niche than Baroque cello, it's probably video game music. So me and my brother are...
Well, I will say video game music pays better.
That it does. But it's still, especially, you know, 5 years ago when he started, if he said, I'm a video game DJ, people are like, what does that even mean? he has a great career now. I mean, that's his full-time gig, 100%. He runs a label of video game remixes. So he's really, really into it on that end. And when he was doing that stuff, I think I was in grad school at the time, and I was just like, Chris, what are you doing? Like, come on, like, get a real job. Like, you're DJing. Like, I was just not feeling, especially as like a classically trained, I was still in school. So I had that like super student-y mentality. I was just not into it at all. And I think anybody, honestly, who doesn't know anything about electronic dance music or DJing should really find someone who has a decent reputation and just go to a live show, just go. And I think it makes a lot more sense when you're there in person and you can feel the energy of a show. You can see a DJ up there doing what they do. You can feel the transition from song to song. You start to get it a lot more. I think just like classical music, if all people did was listen to like fuzzy classical music radio, they might think it's dull. But if they went to a live concert and sat in the first row, they could feel differently. So I know for me, when I first saw my brother play live, I got a much better idea of what DJing was really about. That being said, I didn't jump into it myself right away. I just sort of had a new appreciation and understanding for it. And my brother ran a label, so I got to know some of the people on his label and just sort of get a little more immersed in producing electronic music, DJing, all that kind of stuff. And my brother and I really wanted to collaborate, and we weren't really sure how, especially playing Baroque cello. You know, lots of people want to put cello on their tracks, but it was like, I'm tuned at 415 and that's not really what I do. You know, you want that like lush modern string sound, and that's not really me. So I sort of was at a loss for how to kind of collaborate. So what we ended up doing, I think this was 2013, 2014, my brother and I made a remix album of all Baroque pieces. So this was kind of like a funny project. where we would take MIDI files of Bach, Vivaldi, stuff like that, and we would turn them into these like EDM songs, and we would make them into like dubstep or drum and bass or something. And we spent like a good chunk of time, just me and my brother, kind of in the studio, me teaching him about Baroque music, him teaching me about how to make drums, and sort of going from there. So the final product, Old Style, came out. It was kind of a cool thing, but it's a little bit, it's more of like a science project, I think, than it is like a true listening album, because the hybrid of the styles is cool, but I don't know if that many people would really want to listen to it all the time.
A little bit jarring.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fun, but it's a little bit hard to take seriously, because just sort of the nature of it. I don't know. I mean, lots of people have said they loved it. I'm super proud of it because I think we did a really good job bringing the two things together. But it wasn't so much so that I felt like, okay, well, all I want to do is make classical remixes from now on. It didn't. It felt more like this was a good experiment. This was a cool thing to do, but I'm going to leave it at that. So from there, it was kind of like, well, I'm still sort of interested in this stuff. And, you know, like, how can I get into it? So I finally, with some push and encouragement from my brother, decided like, well, you know, I like pop music. I listen to a lot of hip hop in the car and stuff. So like, maybe it would be cool to start playing around with that. And I started learning how to DJ with a kind of basic home DJ controller and just basically taking like pop songs and songs that I liked and messing around. And what I found is that if you have musical training, DJing is a lot easier. Like, you're already kind of a leg up against a lot of DJs who kind of learn everything by ear. So just kind of understanding like, okay, this is in this key and now we're going to this chord, really makes the DJing process a little quicker. So I found that I was able to get used to it pretty fast and just sort of started falling in love with it, because I never really had a way to take, you know, more popular music or whatever and find a way to kind of make it my own. And DJing was a great way for me to do that. So from there, it sort of took off, and I've been kind of just doing it on a small scale myself. I've done a couple like modest shows. So it's not nearly as big as my cello career, but it's a really nice kind of different way to express myself.
Well, I mean, that's, if you look at it in some way, it's like just two opposite ends of the spectrum. Like very, very, very old music. And then it, and then also that whole cutting edge, idea of, anyway, yeah, that makes sense. Where I was going made sense. So let's, you know, back to the work you do on YouTube and that, that kind of situation. You know, how often are you putting up new things?
So I aim on my YouTube channel, I say once a week. It's more like 3 a month, maybe like a week off here and there when I'm really busy with rehearsals or something extra, or I'm out of town. But I try to shoot for once a week. The summer, my work slows down, so then I can usually get one out once a week.
So what is the, you know, we kind of touched on like why and, but what is your end game, not end game. What is your, basically your mission with putting up things, you know, for people to see every week?
Well, I think for one, there's just not enough classical music overall, but especially early music, just kind of out there on the internet. It becomes this thing that like you have to go to like a little church at 7 p.m. on a Friday night to hear. And I think that's not doing any favors for the longevity of this music, or even in terms of classical music. You have to pay $75 for a seat in a huge concert hall where you sit in the back. So I think bringing this music to people in a place where they already are, which is in front of their computers, is a great way to really get it out there to more people.
That makes sense. And how do you like decide on like what you're going to say or what you're going to do? I mean, do you have a set schedule for the next 3 months of like, oh, I'm going to do this week and this week, or, you know, how does that pan out?
I mean, I have like a little brainstorming note where, you know, I put like, okay, here's some ideas for some teaching videos I could teach about this topic and this topic. Here's some ideas for some repertoire that I have 80% ready to go. Then if I decide, okay, I want to record this movement, I'll practice it and get it ready. Because basically my main things are lessons on some sort of historical performance topic, actual solo cello repertoire. Then sometimes I bring on guests. So then I have like chamber music, which usually that's like, I find the person I want to bring on and I say, what are you working on that sounds good with cello on continuo? And then we'll go from there. And now I'm bringing in this sort of more vlog element where I talk about personal things or I talk about, you know, some career skills that I've learned along the way. So between those kind of like four umbrellas, I always have a few ideas to choose from. I don't have like a super strict schedule. And one of the things I like about my own YouTube channel is if it's 2 days or the day of that I have to film my video, it's like, oh crap, what am I going to do? Okay, I guess I'll just play this. Or like the time that I did the video about being an underdog, I was like, I guess I wanted to talk about being an underdog, so I'll do that. And then I just talked at the camera for 20 minutes and spent some time editing it and then threw it up there. And then it got a bunch of attention. You kind of never know which things are going to do well. And at least for me, being consistent is really important. And if I get too picky or too analytical, I'm just not going to produce anything. So I have to kind of push myself to just say, okay, just get it done. Get it done. Just get something recorded, start editing it, get it up there. So that's kind of been my attitude.
Hey, that's how I started doing a podcast. It worked out well, ish.
Yeah.
It worked out ish. What kind of bump did you get from the attention for talking about your personal story?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of things when you get attention, it really depends how and where the information is shared. So like the Huffington Post interview that I did, for example, that was just kind of a lucky thing. And it looked super prestigious and awesome to be like, wow, I got interviewed in Huffington Post. Amazing. But like, it's not really going to, it doesn't really do that much for me. Like, there's no like immediate link, like give Emily money at the bottom of the article or anything. Right. So it doesn't really do anything except look pretty cool. And like, I guess maybe a few people, I think I got some acknowledgement and, you know, it can continue to give me, you know, but it doesn't give you like concrete traffic or concrete work necessarily. It's more of just like a cool thing that you have now that you can say you did.
Now it's
that
makes on your bio.
Yeah, it looks legitimate. But like, you know, I think that stuff gets like, I don't want to say more attention than it deserves, but it's just funny the types of things we value as professionals and in society.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could say it gets more attention than it deserves. Like, I don't know. It's funny. There's so much content on a place like that on Huffington Post. And there's a similar thing with like people who are producing content like you or me, like, you know, you put something up and then, well, you better be like pushing the next thing pretty soon thereafter or else it's
right.
it's just going to peter out. So I guess those kind of things, it's more of how you use them personally than the actual thing itself, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely.
You, like using that to springboard like just into like even if it's just personal motivation and some extra viewers, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I think especially for news outlets, that's kind of how it is. I think that it's a little bit different depending, you know, like when I was shared by Classic FM, for example, they have a huge Facebook page. I think it has like 800,000 likes or something like that. So when they share my stuff and they're sharing it on Facebook and they tag my Facebook page, that gives me a huge boost because people are already on Facebook and they can just click to my Facebook page and like it. And, you know, it does a great thing. And when they shared my underdog story, they actually put it up on their website and they put my actual YouTube video on there.
Right.
So that got me 10,000 views on that video in one day because they put my direct video on their website. So things like that, it might not look like the most prestigious thing ever, but if it's in a way that's really designed to pass along the traffic, then it does make a huge difference, even if it seems less prestigious. So it's all kind of about how things are being shared and how directly people can reach you from that thing that they're seeing. So it just depends.
Yeah, it's very hard to get people to do anything that takes them out of their normal path of of internet usership.
Yeah,
You
definitely.
know, like I talk to people, it's funny, I talk to people regularly where I'm like, yeah, especially, oh God, especially musicians. I talk to them, I'm like, yeah, I have a podcast. And they're like, oh, how do I listen to it? I'm like, do you have an iPhone? Like, it's literally an app that you cannot delete. Like, you are, you, they, Apple does not let you delete the podcast app from your phone. But that sounds pretty mean and uncharitable of a thing to me to, for me to say, but it's true. Like, it's, and, or even, yeah, if it's something that they have to go to from Facebook or wherever they're browsing, if they have to go to another place, it just makes it more difficult. And, you know, it just means you have to be more interesting, I guess. That's directed at me, not at you.
Well, I think also it's like you have to push things way more than people realize. And the idea of pushing things, you can't assume that every time you push something or link to something or remind someone that everybody saw it that first time. You know, you
Right.
have to keep doing it because someone could have missed it. And then on the third time you post it, that's when someone sees it and that's when they click on it. Or they see it the first time and think nothing of it. Then they see it a second time and think, oh, okay, I'll click on this. And it makes so many people uncomfortable who don't like to promote themselves because they really think that they're like going up to someone's face, reminding them for a third time. And you kind of have to shake that attitude and just say, I have to keep putting this out there because, you know, it's going to get ignored the first few times, or worse, it's not even going to get shown to people the first few times.
Yeah, it's and but there on the other hand, on the, you know, on the same token, there is a balance to be struck because, well, I mean, I'm sure we both know people that overdo it, you know, and
Definitely.
that's frustrating, or overdo some, you know, even if they're not promoting something, they overdo some element of their personality or their beliefs in part, you know, or whatever project they're working on. You know, if you're seeing it 3 times a day, then maybe, you know, then maybe it's a little bit much. But yeah, I totally identify with what you're saying. Like, it feels like you're punching people in the face with what you're doing when it actually mean, you know. And there's so much stuff on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram that I don't think people even notice unless it's coming up 5 times a day.
Yeah, I mean, you have to kind of be heard throughout the noise. And I think there's also a difference between putting things on social media and reaching out to people directly. Like the times that I've gotten really annoyed at, you know, people who are doing some sort of Kickstarter or fundraising thing is like, I have gotten emails, I'm not going to name this organization, like, we met our, you know, we're, you know, 15 days ahead of our deadline and we've met our thing, but it's not over yet. Keep giving us money. I proceeded to get 3 emails from them after they had already met their goal about giving them more money. And it was like, I almost emailed them to just say, like, hey, I'm glad you met your goal, but like, I am unsubscribing from all your stuff from now on because you harassed my inbox when you had all the money you needed. Like, certain discretion things like that. I've gotten, you know, direct Facebook messages from people that are clearly copy and pasted, you know, trying to get
Yeah,
support for something. It's just when you're going to people directly, I think you need a little more sensitivity.
that does drive me crazy. I have there's people there's a few people I am, you know, that there's some people that I know who have who will like, yeah, it's a personal Facebook message. It's not a giant group message, which is nice, but also, yeah, like, come to our show on this night. I'm like, don't you have like 1,000 followers? Why are you messaging me directly? If I could come, I would definitely come because I like what you do. But don't, come on. That's so, you know, on that same line of questioning, like, how do you approach it personally? How do you approach your self-promotion?
I try to put things out there for my followers and my audience as much as possible because I figure if you like my page, if you follow my Instagram, if you subscribe to my YouTube channel, you probably want to know what I'm doing. So I will let you know through those platforms. I personally don't love like integrating my personal Facebook page with a lot of promotion because especially once you start to make so much of your professional life your social media presence, it's kind of nice to have like one place where you can like post a picture of your dad on Father's Day or whatever, and you don't like everything doesn't have to be work related. So I try to keep those things separate when I can. I'm not big on blurring the line between is this person a friend or are they a colleague or are they networking with me or are they nice or are they trying to get something out of me? I just feel like I like to keep the promotion stuff really where it belongs, which is on the Facebook page, on the Twitter account, like whatever those places are, because I'd like to think those people want to know that stuff. So, you know, anytime I do anything noteworthy, I try to share it on those platforms, whether it's a new video, I have a new piece of press, I have something cool going on. You know, I try to share that stuff regularly because I do think consistency is really important in keeping your social media audience interested. And especially if your content is good, if you are providing something that is interesting, a good picture, a good story, a produced video, whatever it is, that's information that you want to share. You know, if you're filling the time with, like, you know, kind of bullshit, then yeah, you're going to be bombarding people. But I think so long as your content is high quality, you should be sharing regularly.
Yeah. and like you said, if your content is good, people like, and if it's good and you're proud of it, like, why would you not, like,
right,
give it to people? Mm-hmm. Like, what's the point of having it if you're not gonna do anything with it? So what do you have coming up in the near future? I mean it is the summer, so you know, basically it's like hoping you had enough, you saved enough money to get you between gigs.
But... yep, exactly. But yeah, I mean, I love the summer because I do a lot of private lesson teaching, which I really like. Well, that's a little bit of an exaggeration. I do like, I'm not super resentful of it. Let's put it that way. I have some really great kids and great families. But a lot of them take off for the summer. And then of course, you know, gigs and everything slows down. But I really, really like having the slow time. That was like, it was really only last year that I got my YouTube channel really going. And I think it was around you know, January, February that I started doing it. But it wasn't until the summer that I really had the time to like jump in. And I had launched Patreon, which is like a crowdfunding site for my YouTube channel in the springtime. But once the summer rolled around, I had all this time to be making videos. And my Patreon really grew and my channel really grew. So I love the summer because it's a really good time to just work on stuff for me and not feel like, oh, I never have any time to do anything. And like during the school year when all my students are here and the gigs are more plentiful, it's like I have one day off and that becomes YouTube day. So I'm just working 7 days a week trying to get everything done. So the summer is just like I can actually relax a little bit. I can spend more time on the YouTube videos and just sort of recharge my batteries because I'm sure, as you know, like freelance life is pretty much 7 days a week. And I don't like to spend money on vacations and I think most of us can't afford them anyway. So just having some days off, some time to kind of chill out in the summer is just really useful for me.
I was on the phone with my mom recently and she was like, well, you keep talking about like getting through the summer. Like what's such a big deal when like September rolls around? I'm like, oh, that's just when people hire, it doesn't matter. Like school never really ends. I mean, it ends, but unless you have one of those like really good, you know, Radio City, Broadway, you know, kind of deals for the summer, you're pretty much hoping that you, you made enough in April and May to get you through, right. it's so weird that, you know, you spend all this time like, oh yeah, I'm going to be done with school. And then you're as a freelancer, it's kind of like, well, I mean, I'm not in school, but it sure kind of feels like it in a weird way. Like it's like, oh, the summer, you know, it's like you're a teacher, but you're not teaching anyone. At least I only have a few students, but anyway, that was my personal color. So, Emily, thank you so much for agreeing to talk with me.
It's been great.
It's great.
Mm-hmm.